For the week of May 10th, 2020, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 493, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the newsmaking entertainment, on the newsmaking headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Birmingham, Alabama, I'm Michael Giltz. Hey there, Sperling.
Hi, how are you? I hope we have entertaining news, though. I do hope that, you know.
We have entertainment news for sure.
Yes. Yes. That's kind of what I meant to say.
The entertaining part is on us.
Yes. We have to make it entertaining.
How are we going to do that this week?
Well, I guess this week on Showbiz Sandbox, we're going to try and make it entertaining by not inviting any guests. That's really what we're trying to do. No, we're not going to peer into a crystal ball and predict the future. It's just Michael and me and the news. Think of it as like podcast comfort food, you know, like good old times. We'll cover the latest news on what's happening as the industry recovers from the pandemic. Some good stuff is happening. The lights are back on at theme parks and film sets, at least in certain countries. We'll also look at the most popular movies on demand because, you know, drive-ins only get you so far.
Jawohl.
On Inside... I'm sorry?
Jawohl. It was a little inside joke there. Yeah.
A little inside joke because we're doing a drive-in story over at Celluloid Junkie, but it's drive-ins or car cinemas, as they're called, in Germany.
Cool. Looking forward to seeing that.
Now, on Inside Baseball, we'll run down some of the many changes being considered in North America when movie and TV sets start buzzing again. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll discuss some of the week's top headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on last week's video on demand charts. Now, while he does that, I'm going to go over to the craft service table at one of those new productions that's launching.
Careful. Put on your hazmat suit first. Okay. We are looking at video on demand. These are just the basic video on demand. They do not include premium video on demand. And we don't know what they're grossing. We just know how they're ranked in order of popularity. So for the week of April 27th through May 2nd, the most popular film in video on demand was Bad Boys for Life, the Martin Lawrence Will Smith flick. At number two is a new movie. It's Sonic the Hedgehog. At number three is last week's number two. It's the Tiffany Haddish comedy Like a Boss. At number four is Ben Affleck in The Way Back. Don't have that second drink. And at number five is Harrison Ford in The Call of the Wild. Number six is the Guy Ritchie crime drama, The Gentleman. Then another new film, it's Brahms, The Boy 2. That's a horror flick from STX Entertainment. And right below that is another new film, probably a little bit less familiar to a lot of people. It's The Assistant, written and directed by Kitty Green, which went the festival circuit and is coming out from Universal. And number nine is Underwater. And number 10, Jumanji, The Next Level. Of course, like all this stuff, there's real money being made. Even though video on demand is far less popular than it was, say, 5 years ago, it's still a $9 billion market in North America. So that's real money.
Yeah, I mean, certainly the word billion is thrown around a lot these days with, you know, government subsidies and, you know, number of, you know, amount of money lost
our billion subscribers to Showbiz Sandbox. Rate and review
us. Please do rate and review us on any of the podcast aggregators that are out there that we happen to be on. By the way, The Assistant is Focus Features, which I guess is Universal.
Mm-hmm. Good for clearing that up. It's a movie about,
you know, there
the
is
film
some box
industry.
Office. I'm surprised you didn't want to mention the box office because there are about 30 or 40 theaters that are open right now.
Well, I didn't find a deadline rundown of what had happened where. So, you know, if they were the ones that were doing the best coverage of drive-in movie theaters, but sometimes it takes them later in the day on money to get to that. It doesn't come through as quickly as stuff via ComScore or the over-the-weekend usual reports. If you've got some info to share, please do.
Yes, you can write to us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com.
Oh, I meant you.
Oh, okay. Oh.
Had you read something?
Oh, no. I just saw a couple of the grosses for some of the theaters that were opening. They're not very good. And they're mostly in Texas. There's like a few in Utah, one in South Carolina, a smattering of some in Alabama. Most of them are drive-ins, as you mentioned.
Mm-hmm. Why in Texas we eat coronavirus for lunch, along with our Corona beer. Anyway, hopefully everybody's being safe, and drive-ins are a great way to keep going to the movies during this period. But some of those movies have gone straight to streaming. I'm not sure if, did The Assistant play theatrically, or is that a straight to video on demand as well?
I think it opened theatrically, mm-hmm. and then It wouldn't
have been a big release. It was an art film. So, you know, it's about the film industry. So, you know, even if it got a release, it's not like it was stymied from its 3,000 screen release. It's not that kind of film. But anyway, whether it did or not, it will be eligible for the Academy Award. However, once they clarified that, yes, this year they're going to change the rules, as long as you intended or had a theatrical release, you could put your film up for an Academy Award nomination. The Emmy people raised their hand and said, hey, by the way, no double dipping. If you get an Oscar nomination, you're not going to get an Emmy nomination. So think twice before you try and, you know, submit your film for both categories. We have seen documentaries like the O.J. Simpson one. That one won the Oscar and then went on to win the Emmy. So the Emmys are saying, yeah, that's great. We're not going to do that anymore, especially this year where there's so many more films that the line is blurry.
Yeah, and I can tell you that it opened January 31st. Now, I saw The Assistant in Sundance. It opened January 31st, 2020, theatrically in 4 screens.
Cool.
And it made 8,120. It averaged $8,125 per screen for an average of $32,500. And to date, has made $1.1 million theatrically.
Well done. Did you like the film?
I thought it was good. It's done by a documentarian, as you know, the director is a documentarian, and it's very, it's almost like a documentary. It's a day in the life of an assistant, who's a kind of a woman who works for a misogynist who I don't think we ever see throughout the entire film. I don't think we see them. We get their, that's the most interesting aspect of it, is how this person, in a way, tortures their female, their third assistant, by the way, who happens to be female, but from afar. It's pretty remarkable.
Well, you know, documentaries are probably being filmed right now. I know film crews are out with protective gear doing things like filming empty Times Square, covering the coronavirus epidemic. So they have never really stopped production, though hopefully with a lot of restrictions to keep themselves safe. But good news has happened, and that's coming from New Zealand. That country has a great, is it Prime Minister? I believe so. And she's done a great job. And
Jacinda. Yes, Jacinda.
That's right. And dealing with the coronavirus. And they have resumed film and TV production. They have started filming again on certain shows and movies. We're not sure of all the new rules they have in place, though surely they have them. We're not sure if this includes Avatar. There's also that Amazon series that's set in the world of Middle Earth, aka The Lord of the Rings. That's been filming in New Zealand. Whether those two in particular have started back up again, we don't know, but stuff is beginning to film. So that's certainly good news for everybody.
I can tell you it does include Avatar because James Cameron has been sharing some pictures of production. I'm assuming they are same day, that they're not.
Well, that wasn't clarified because one of the trades saw that and said it wasn't clear if that was a new one, a new image, or an old one with him teasing that he's going to get back to work. I think they would have updated if Avatar had begun filming, but I could have missed that. So, yeah, we all certainly hope so. And obviously, he'll be doing it soon. That's certainly the message that he's sending, I think. So that's great. You deal with it responsibly, smartly, take action, get widespread testing and proper equipment, and then you can get back to life to sort of normal. We won't be really back to normal till we get a vaccination, but there you go.
And before we hear from a number of you about The Assistant, yes, it is not a Focus feature. It is not Universal. It is Bleecker Street Media.
Well, the Comscore chart said Universal next to the film.
It might be. That might be
for the video on demand.
Correct.
Oh, I didn't think that would be a different thing than the other. Oh, I guess of course it should be. Well, thank you for clarifying that. One thing we can also clarify is that theme parks, we had our friend Claudia from the producers group on the show 2 weeks ago, something like that. And she was giving us a lot of info and insight into the theme park world, the amusement park world. And we know they're losing a lot of money. Disney parks worldwide lost $1 billion so far this year. So
was that just the parks, or was that Disney in general lost $1 billion?
I believe it was the parks. And that, of course, would be an estimate. Okay. It's in terms of lost business and expenses that they had to pay. So these are all rough estimates. But I believe
No. They actually said, here's our earnings statement. In that quarter, we lost $1 billion in profit. And it came from theme parks.
There you go. But the good news is that Disneyland Shanghai, which is the biggest Disney theme park outside of North America, that opened up today, May 11th. They're going to have masks and temperature checks and contact tracing, though I'm not sure how a theme park would do that. But they're going to have limited attendance with pulsed entry, meaning People come in waves and reservations are required. You can't just show up and buy a ticket. They're going to have 24,000 people there on the first day. That's out of a capacity of about 125,000. They say it's 20% of total capacity. So if you times that by five, you get about 120,000, 125,000 people that they can handle in a regular day. So 20% capacity, and tickets sold out immediately for the full first week. So,
well, oh, wow. Actually, that's interesting. And I wonder if part of that is the fact that what they are doing is saying, if you decide to come, well, you can go on all the rides you want, because instead of 125,000 people, we're only going to have 20% of the people. It'll basically be like a friends and family night here at the park. So now is actually a pretty good time to come. Plus, it's in China. There's 1.4 billion people. People are going to show up.
Well, yes, there's certainly the allure of knowing the park will not be at capacity. But of course, there's also the risk, and they're putting in the measures in place that have convinced people they feel safe and comfortable going back. I think we see different polls in North America. People saying, are you ready to go to a Broadway show as soon as it opens up again? People are like, oh, I don't know. Are you ready to go to a movie? Some are like, yes. Others are like, yeah, do I want to take my kids? You know, maybe you would decide, right, I'm going to put a full mask on. Do you want to take your kids to see Mulan? Will you do that on July 24th, when Mulan opens?
You know what? I probably will, because they are kind of mature enough to know, hey, you know what? Stop touching everything. Okay. And wear your mask. And, you know, first of all, I don't know if they want to see Mulan. So let's start there for a second.
Well, just assume it's a family-friendly film that you want to take them to and they would normally like to see.
Yeah, I mean, I might. Certainly, I know people who have like 2, 3, 4, 5, 6-year-olds.
Well,
I can't get them to stop touching everything.
Right, right. No, we're talking about your kids, your age. You would say, yes, I will take them to a movie. You'll feel comfortable doing that right away.
I can tell you this. It's kind of like... I hate to use this analogy. It's kind of a morbid analogy, but somebody has once told me, a pilot once told me, that it's never safer to fly, more safe to fly than after
an accident.
An airline. Yeah. So you want to talk about cleanliness? These people are like scrubbing down everything in these movie theaters. I've been talking to exhibitors who have opened, and they are just being so cautious and diligent about they're watching what people touch, and they're immediately wiping it down right after they touch it. There's somebody, you can only use kiosks to buy a ticket, and they really strongly encourage you to use a mobile phone to buy a ticket instead. And as soon as somebody touches the kiosk, they're out there with the, you know, wiping off the
kiosk. Well, that's what they're going to do, right. But of course, that's all in the context of no widespread testing available, not enough equipment for the first responders, the people on the front lines, and no vaccine. And we don't have enough people for contact tracing either. We need hundreds of thousands of workers to do contact tracing around the country. That's at a minimum, a couple hundred thousand people doing that job. We have none of that in this country. So I might feel comfortable going back to the movies and say South Korea or New Zealand, right, or Taiwan.
Right, yeah.
But I'm not sure I feel comfortable, certainly not taking my kids. You know, and your attitude may change if there's a second wave in June. If we have 3,000 deaths a day, people will either become inured to that and go, oh, well, that's the new normal. Or they'll say, oh, my God, this is just as bad as ever. Why in hell are we opening up again? We'll have
to see. The doctors I've been speaking with have said, most of them have said, you know what, that's what's going to wind up happening. As we open up, people will become, they'll be like this baseline death rate that people just become kind of, they just accept it. It's when it spikes, when that death rate spikes and that infection rate spikes, that's when people will start to say, whoa, wait a second.
3,000 deaths a day in June, which is the estimate, that would be 50% higher than the death rates we have right now. Well, the last week we've had 2,000 plus deaths 3 days out of the last week. So that will be a big spike. That'll be a 50% increase every single day.
Yeah, so I think the doctors I was speaking with were assuming that it would drop below 3,000, like be around 1,000 a day.
Well, I don't know why they would assume that, since everything I see says differently, but we shall see. And certainly people's attitude towards going back to the movies will rise and fall depending on how bad the pandemic is in their city and state and, of course, around the country. But in Disneyland Shanghai, the good news is people there do feel comfortable under those conditions with 20% capacity. They are ready to go to a theme park. They're also at home watching Disney Plus. That hit 54.5 million subscribers. So that's the good news. Here's the bad news.
Is that worldwide? I'm assuming that's worldwide.
Yes, that's worldwide. Yeah, okay. And here's the bad news. Disney announced no dividend payment in July. Now, wait, is that bad news? That's been a long time, if ever, since they have not had a dividend payment. But that's one of the main criticisms coming from like Abigail Disney and other people saying, hey, you're laying off people, not paying salaries, reducing salaries, but you're going to do a dividend payment and hand out money to investors as if everything's going well. By not having this dividend payment, they will save $1.6 billion. Guess what? That $1 billion they lost from their parks, they just got it back. Maybe you shouldn't be handing out dividends to investors when things aren't going well, when you can't pay your employees their full salary. Maybe that should be better spent on your employees and, you know, your company's coffers. So that is a good move by Disney, I feel.
Yeah, I mean, people say, well, you know, I've heard, you know, Microsoft, for instance, for years never had a dividend, right?
Right.
But people who
Amazon
own, you know,
never had a profit.
Right.
But people, you know, who owned the stock were happy because it continued to rise in value.
Right. And people were earning more in the rise in stock value than they would have if they had earned a dividend. However, what ideally, you know, if you own 2 million shares of a stock, or even 100,000 shares of a stock, or 50,000 shares of a stock, and they're paying, you know, 15-cent dividends, start doing the math on that. That's a good chunk of change.
Well, yes,
per quarter.
But the question is, who are you responsible to? And right now, we're in a mindset in America of like the only person that matters is the person owning stock, as opposed to the employees, the company, the community you're in, the city and state and country. It used to be that everybody was a stakeholder, and the people owning stock were the least of your concerns. First, you made sure your employees had a good salary. Then you made sure they had great benefits and could move up in the company. Then you made sure that you were a good neighbor in your community and city and state. Now that's sort of trite and silly, and people roll their eyes, and all that matters is quarterly profits and shoveling money back into the top tier management, just the top handful, and the investors, and to hell with the rest of the thousands of people who work at your company and your community and city and state. So it's a mindset. Who matters most? Is it stockholders?
I will say EG here, you know, E period, G period.
For example,
Walmart.
Yeah.
Walmart.
Yeah.
You know, that's a perfect example of a company where, you know, the employees make like $8 an hour and are on food stamps, yet they have full-time jobs.
Not everybody. I don't think that's the median salary pay at Walmart, but yes, they have a lot of part-time employees when they have enough work for full-time, but most companies don't want employees at all, much less full-time ones. Well, let's get back to some good news. Cinemas in Hong Kong are slowly reopening. That started on May 8th, last Friday. We're recording on Monday, May 11th. And the movies opening were Trolls World Tour, Emma, along with some new and recent local fare. So that's great. China said, hey, cinemas can reopen. And the cinemas, having learned you don't act until the government tells you specifically what you can do, says, okay, what should we do? They are waiting for further clarification from the government. In the UK, that clarification has been muddled. First, they said cinemas can open in late June. Then they said, well, hold on a second. No earlier than July 4th. Fair enough. They should change their dates depending on the latest information. However, the UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson went on TV last night and seemed to just sow confusion by saying everybody should stay at home unless they can go to work, in which case they shouldn't, but they should, but be careful, but go outside and exercise, but stay away from each other, but don't, but enjoy yourselves, but be careful, but go to work, but don't. That's literally how, I mean, it was just a disaster of a speech. In fact, Ireland, Scotland, and Wales says they are not going along. They're going to stick with their stay-at-home orders. They found what England was doing confusing, misleading, and not backed by the science. So that's a big kerfuffle in the UK. But they're hoping maybe in a month and a half, they can get their cinemas reopened again. Australian cinema, they plan to open in July with Christopher Nolan's Tenet. So that's all good news. People really think they're going to open in July, and Christopher Nolan is really excited by having Tenet help restart people's love affair with the movies. Are you excited?
Well, he's really gunning. He wants that movie. He wants his movie to be the movie that helps reopen cinemas.
Well,
that, he really does.
That's awesome. Maybe it should happen in September or January of 2021. Not in July of 2020. I hope that can be possible. I hope it makes sense. And I hope if it does, it runs for 3 or 4 or 5 months, you know, at half capacity and all those screens and pulls in a lot of money, because that's how long it'll take to make your money back. There's no reason it should be a loss leader.
all of the exhibitors I've spoken with said, yeah, you're only going to get half the capacity in your cinemas, but you'll get twice the screens. Like, is it a little
until the following week when Mulan opens
when
up.
Mulan, yeah.
When and then
Mulan
2 weeks up. Later when Wonder, you know, so it's going to get backed up pretty quick. I'm not sure how they would continue to do that, but that we'll see what's going. At least cinemas are opening up in different countries around the world. In the West End, that's the theater world, they continued their lockdown through at least the end of June. But on the other hand, soccer, Germany's Bundesliga is ready to open in late May, presumably without fans in attendance. And of course, we've talked about some companies here and some criticism of them. The Hollywood Reporter has a great story about CEO pay. They frame the story as saying media execs foregoing or cutting their salary, please. They talk about how that's an empty gesture and how maybe that CEO pay just will not fly in this post-pandemic era. I say that's a lovely thought, but I doubt it happens. But we have a link to it in our show notes.
Well, yeah, this is the article about how, yes, okay, your pay is reduced. However, your bonuses, which is really what you live off of, what you actually make.
Your total compensation package is much bigger than your base salary because you don't want to pay taxes on it. But more importantly, they're saying maybe this will not become acceptable. Maybe your total compensation is so out of whack and it's so obscene that maybe people are going to rise up and say, that's not acceptable anymore in a publicly traded company. I'd love to see that happen, to get back to the way we were in the 50s and 60s when we had a strong middle class and great economy, but I don't think it's going to happen. If it did, it would be
a big deal. A big deal. I see what you're doing there, but you know, I think what would be a big deal is that you, my friend, are jumping on the MAGA bandwagon. You're trying to make America great again.
I am indeed.
Yes. But in the meantime, while you make America great again, I'm wondering what you think of some of our stories in Big Deal or Big Whoop.
America was always great. Anyway, keep going.
Okay. Well, Big Deal or Big Whoop is our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Here's our first story. Really, I almost led with this. And if I hadn't seen that it was in Big Deal or Big Whoop, I guess I would have mentioned it.
Say something to you to don't mention it. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, my question really is Amazon kicking the tires on the theater chain AMC. The debt-laden exhibitor could definitely be in play, and Amazon is flush with cash and looking for acquisitions. Buying AMC would give the shipping company, I love it, it's not a retail company, it's a shipping company, a lot of flexibility when it comes to showing movies on its digital platforms in cinemas. 90-day windows? What 90-day windows? Hey, when you own the exhibition chain, you can choose any damn window you want. The Daily Mail reports the two companies had talks, but it was unclear if they were still ongoing. And Patrick Von Sikowski over at CJ, Cellular Junkie, my stomping ground, said, keep in mind, it was the Daily Mail. Big Deal or Big Whoop.
You just stepped on my line. The Daily Mail. They are not going to break a story about Amazon over, buying out AMC. I find that inconceivable. So I'm not sure why the trades even reported that the Daily Mail said that, because it's just nonsense. It doesn't mean it's not happening. We know Amazon is all over the place looking at stuff to buy. It would be bizarre if they didn't speak to AMC. They certainly looked at buying Landmark, didn't they?
They did. And I think that they looked at the numbers and went, yeah, I'm sorry, you want way too much for this. It's not worth it.
Well, maybe AMC is at rock bottom prices. So it would be a big deal if somebody reputable said they were still having ongoing talks. The Daily Mail, ignore it.
Now, what I can tell you, people might say, oh my God, that's way too much money for Amazon to put into a business. Or, why would they spend that much money on a business? Keep in mind, I don't know what their market cap is. But first of all, it's fallen by 80% since last year. Okay.
Though investors, as one person said, investors would not be interested in a deal that only values them at their current level. They'd say, we'll hold on until our stock gets back up again.
Right. Well, that would be, so their market cap right now is $598.35 million. Okay. Now they have billions of dollars worth of debt. Okay. So there's that for a little, kind of reminder as to where we are. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, you have Amazon, who, when it wants to get into a business, it goes out and it buys Whole Foods for, $14 billion, nearly $14 billion. So, we'll give you your market cap times two. So that's like $1 billion right there. We'll throw in all the money for debt. That's $6 billion, total. yeah, sure, we'll do that. No problem. Here you go.
Yeah, it's a very conceivable deal, very conceivable possibility. It's a very different buy for Amazon. It doesn't play into their digital cinema as such. I mean, their online world of retail, it gives them hard tops, you know? It's like they, you know, it's one thing to buy Whole Foods. It's another thing to buy a gazillion theater chains, which is just a marginal play for them right now. You know, theaters are just sort of a nice add-on to the movies they put on their streaming service. But maybe it makes sense. They've certainly got pile of cash.
Yeah, Jeff Bezos has been going Hollywood for a long time now. He's bought a house in Bel Air. Ah. And so, you know, I think, you know, it's not inconceivable. Plus, you'd have all of those places where you could now return, you know, items from Amazon.
Well, let me ask you this, Sperling. It's been a bad week for employees at the talent agency William Morris Endeavor. Like AMC, they've been burdened by a huge amount of debt and needed everything to go right for their plans to succeed. Then the pandemic struck. Now, 20% of WME has been hit one way or another. One out of five employees has been fired, furloughed, or been reduced to part-time. And the parent company, Endeavor, just arranged a $250 million term loan. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, it's kind of a big deal, and here's why. I guess a lot of people say, well, it's a big whoop. Of course they're laying people off. Mm-hmm. But here's the thing. So, you know, to buy IMG, the event company, William Morris Endeavor really took on a lot of debt. It was like a $4 billion deal, and a lot of it was leveraged. So just to service the debt, they need a revenue stream. They need money coming in. Under normal circumstances, you know what? It's not a bad move. You know, they were doing okay. Not great, but okay. They needed literally everything to go right. No mistakes, no hiccups at all to pull this off. Well, this was a giant hiccup. This was more like a heart attack. Mm-hmm. And that's the problem, is what you're really seeing is, okay, they furloughed or laid off workers. Okay, so all of the administrative workers, there's no need for them right now, so they're all gone. But at the same time, a lot of their income and all of these agencies' income comes from live events. 50% of their revenue comes from live events. Who knows when that will return? Sure, you might have, production start, television and film production start, but you have no idea when, you know, concerts will start. And that's 50% of your business. Mm-hmm. That's really what you're hearing.
Hmm. Yeah, well, you know, right. I would have said, well, gee, everybody's laying off, but you make a great point about that debt burden that they have.
Yeah, and that's the problem. I mean, I can't imagine William Morris Endeavor will wind up going away, but I do think it might be a different company on the other side of this.
And that's why it's frustrating when companies spend billions of dollars buying back stock, and then they demand a bailout because they don't have any cash on hand.
Right, exactly. Which is why, actually, part of the CARES Act was you can't use that money to buy back stock.
Poorly enforced.
Yes.
Keep going.
I can't say this properly. The Pulitzer Prize winners have been announced, and history was made repeatedly. Author Colson Whitehead won his second Pulitzer, this time for the novel The Nickel Boys. In journalism, Nicole Hannah-Jones won for her writing on the New York Times package of The 1619 Project. And in theater, the musical A Strange Loop by Michael R. Jackson was named Best Drama. It's just the 10th musical in history to win the Pulitzer, the first musical by a black man to win the Pulitzer, and the first musical yet to play on Broadway to win the Pulitzer. That is actually pretty remarkable.
We would have played on Broadway, but things got in the way.
Further, poetry winner Jericho Brown is also a black man, so while the winner of the History Award was white, but his book focuses on the black experience and is called A Sweet Taste of Liberty. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big deal. It was a great week for people of color at the Pulitzers. There have been criticisms about other stuff, and personally, I don't think the Nickel Boys is nearly good enough to win the Pulitzer Prize. I liked it. I did not love it at all, not even close. Two or three or four of his other novels are far more deserving, of course, including the winner, Underground Railroad. But, you know, he's a great writer and is having a great career, so I can't get that upset. And the 1619 Project, I have still not dived into that, but I am looking forward to it very much.
Now, I wonder if one of those musicals was the 2.5-hour jazz oratorio, Blood on the Fields by Wynton Marsalis. Do you think that was one of the 10 musicals?
This is the first musical by a black man to win the Pulitzer, so... That was, I believe, was not considered a musical. That was a piece of classical music, which is a different category.
Got it. Okay. Now, we talked about Sinclair Broadcast Group last week, and they're in the news again, ironically. They're kind of always in the news for some reason. Go figure. This time, the company has paid a record $48 million fine from the FCC here in the United States. And they did that to settle numerous investigations into the company's actions. In 2017, the company paid a $17 million fine amidst complaints from two of the Dems that it wasn't harsh enough given the many violations of FCC policy and the company's repeated refusal to follow, you know, this little thing called the law. Now, you might be asking, okay, so what did Sinclair do now? Okay, well, here's what it did. It aired paid programming, essentially infomercials. Okay, that's what paid programming is. And they did that 1,700 times without disclosing it was actually a paid ad. Now, it's paying a $48 million fine over actions taken during its failed attempt to merge with Tribune and become a behemoth in terms of market share. Sinclair claimed it would divest itself of various TV stations and other media outlets, but that was kind of a lie. Its plan was to set up shell companies controlled by family members of Sinclair, thus maintaining control of a vast majority of the U.S. market well beyond legal limits. The company has previously been criticized for stifling local control of TV outlets by forcing stations to run propaganda pieces disguised as local news stories, a practice it says it ended in December 2019. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big whoop. A record $48 million fine is peanuts for Sinclair Broadcast Group. If the fine is not more than just the cost of doing business, it is not going to have any effect, as proven by the fact that they keep breaking the law, seem incapable of following the law, and yet, of course, you know, can shrug off a record fine and will not lose their license because the head of the FCC said, oh, now some political people want us to toll their license, but that's crazy. Well, if they can't keep following the law and are trying to deceive you, what do you have to do to lose your license? It seems very hard indeed. But let's not pretend that everybody hates Sinclair or that's not true. Progressives do, people who like facts do, but they're mostly not even aware of for most people. People in the industry are aware of them, but most people don't recognize that the local TV station is akin to a Fox News outlet, and they don't know what that means in terms of what they're watching and the editorial and the message that they receive. So unfortunately, more people are not aware of them and don't know whether or not they should like them.
Yeah, I mean, if you really want a good overview of Sinclair, I would say look up the John Oliver Last Week Tonight piece he did on them. I think it was last year, because it's a very good overview on just what Sinclair Broadcast Group
is up to.
I'll
have to check it out. I haven't seen that.
Now, for years, we've been poo-pooing the hysteria over cord cutting. Okay.
Poo-poo.
Yeah. Well, actually, there was a front page headline in the Los Angeles Times that said the way that some epidemiologists are trying to figure out how far, at least in California, the coronavirus has spread is through poop. They literally had the word poop in the headline. I was like, what? They couldn't use fecal matter? Like, they didn't want to use that? But yes, they're kind of measuring the coronavirus in the sewage, actually, is what they're measuring. In any case, if people cancel their traditional cable package, but then add an OTT, over-the-top cable-like service, and a handful of streaming channels, that's not a sign of people abandoning TV. That's a sign of competition and customers turning to a more economical service. Not so fast, says COVID-19. Amidst the economic collapse, cord cutting has become bad, like for real bad, okay? Sure. In the first quarter of 2020, traditional TV subscribers fell by a record 1.8 million subscribers. For the year, subscribers are down by 7%, which, by the way, also a record. I mean, think about that. If you are declining 7% in anything that you're doing, economically, not good. We're also seeing a slowdown or reversal in digital subscribers, with YouTube being the big winner and some others falling hard. Yes, Disney Plus and other streamers are a bright note, but that revenue won't begin to cover all the losses. Again, digital dimes for analog dollars, big deal or big whoop?
Well, I think it's a big deal. We already talked about, people are overstating the cord-cutting world, but when there's a Great Depression in the loom, when 33 million people are out of work, then they really do look at that $130, $140 cable bill and say, hey, Maybe I can get by with a lot less. They're certainly not flocking to over-the-top services. So this is genuine cord cutting, not because people have grown tired of television or are turning to somewhere else for their entertainment, but they just simply need to cut money somewhere because money's not coming in the door. So it's happening for real now, not for the reasons people said. And when you get back into having an over-the-top service and adding in Netflix and Disney Plus and Hulu, that adds up really damn quickly to where you're getting up to a similar capable, especially since you have to keep paying for Wi-Fi somewhere else. So yeah, it is happening now, but not for the reasons that people have always imagined. And to clarify something you said, Wynton Marsalis was the second person of color to win the Pulitzer Prize for music. He did it in 1997 for Blood on the Fields. The first guy was just 1 year earlier, the great George Walker, who won in 1996 for his work, Lilacs. I should say he's the first African-American. I assume he's the first person of color. Maybe I'm wrong.
Well, now, you know, it's interesting that you should be talking about cord cutting now, because I had a technician from Spectrum Cable, which is the only cable company I can get here in Southern California, because Comcast has Northern California, Spectrum has Southern California. In North America, there are these geographic monopolies. Don't get me started. But because we are doing the CJ Cinema Summit each week, I had to upgrade my speed because my download speed was okay. You know, it was like, you know, 50 megabit per second. Not great, but not horrible. But my upload speed was like 1.5 megabit per second.
Did you get a T1 line or what'd you get?
Oh God, no, no, I couldn't get a T1 line. So I said, okay, I'll pay for enhanced service, 200 megabit per second down, 15 megabit per second up. Now, you never fully get the 200 or the 15, but you know, maybe you can get close.
It should be better.
It should be better. That said, it was not. Oh. So the technician comes and is playing around with the box. Now, mind you, a technician showing up live in person to your house during this time period, kind of an issue.
I had a guy in my house too. Everybody else stayed away. I wore a mask and stayed 6 feet away and talked to him about what I had done while he helped with my cable service. What did you do? I assume the same.
Yeah, pretty much. Great. And I can tell you that, and he was very kind and wore a mask and gloves.
Great.
But what he said is, look, you should not pay for increased service because you are not going to get it. We went out to the street, figured out what the speed should be. It was 1.2 gigabit per second down.
That's the best you're going to get.
Yeah, and 44 megabit per second up. That is literally the best you could get. Now, that said, we then went back inside and went into the modem, and he said, yeah, you can only get 70 to 90 megabit per second down, and maybe 7 to 10 megabit per second up on a good day.
Because of the connection from the last mile from the street to your house, or the modem you had, or what's the reason?
Because of the head end, all of these nodes, they're not really set up to have all of the traffic coming from residential areas. They're set up to have all the traffic coming from commercial areas.
They're not supposed to go up.
Right, exactly. So what they need to do is start splitting nodes. And I think it's very technical, but they just need more throughput for residential areas.
Okay.
And so he said, look, you shouldn't bother. Don't try and increase your bandwidth. You're not going to get it. Until we can fix this problem, you just won't get it. For downstream downloading and streaming, you're fine. 70 megabit per second. To give you some sense, over the air HD television, you receive it at 18 megabit per second. Ah. So you're fine with 50 or 60 or 70 megabit per second.
Okay. That's interesting. Well,
but that wraps up.
That's pretty insidery baseball, isn't it? That sounds like a real insidery look into why you're not able to get better uploading service. Well, you really nailed it down. So perfect for our next section.
That's right, because our next section is Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business, and more importantly, how they affect you. Now, you might wonder why I was going into that whole spiel about, stuff. And I'll tell you why. Here's the real truth. Here's a little bit
You're
of making
launching
sausage.
A TV network.
No. I actually looked at our time and went, oh my God, we're only 40 minutes in? Are you kidding me?
You shouldn't do that.
We've got a vamp.
I hope you're kidding.
Oh my goodness. No, we're not going to be talking
Keep
about
going.
That anymore. But no, we are going to be talking about how we will be hanging out at the craft service table on future film sets.
We won't.
And going, wait, where are all the M&Ms? where are all the pretzels? Where's the food at my craft service table?
All right, so there's the kicker. Fox TV announced the new fall schedule lineup, and it's mostly pandemic-proof. The network has filled primetime with TV shows whose seasons are already in the can, such as the show LA's Finest, which they pulled from another platform, Filthy Rich, and Next. They also have reality shows and docs that are also ready to go, like Cosmos and MasterChef Junior, along with a clutch of animated sitcoms, since animation is one of the industry areas that can keep going remotely. It's not perfect, but they can do it a lot better than anything else. They're not sure about the NFL or The Masked Singer, since remote episodes of other competition shows like The Voice and American Idol haven't exactly set the world on fire. But whether or not TV production can get back to normal, Fox is set for the fall. They're not counting on filming new episodes, but they'd sure like to. And that brings us to today's topic. What will TV and film sets look like until we find a vaccine and make it widely available? Deadline and
or a treatment, you know, either
well,
way.
Well, that helps too. We have to have widespread testing, contact tracing, a very effective treatment, and then ultimately a vaccine. So Deadline.
And I think what I'm trying to say is there will not be a craft service table.
Yeah, that's right. Deadline and Variety have had numerous stories on what TV and film sets might be like post-pandemic. All of the following are possibilities being discussed by studios, guilds, and health experts. One big question is, will they be able to get insurance? Can you insure your show when you have a pandemic still out there? Will they go forward anyway, even if they can't get insurance?
The answer is you probably can, but it will be very expensive.
Mm-hmm. They're talking about maybe doing a 2-week quarantine for cast and crew before work begins, meaning, hey, you're going to start filming a season, you're going to quarantine for 2 weeks, and you're going to stay quarantined with just the people you work with until the season is over. That is a hardship. No?
Yeah, I think that really what they're talking about is saying, okay, it's like production summer camp. You're going to go, you're going to live with the people that you shoot with while you're in production. You're going to, and you won't be leaving. It's almost like you're a juror on a court case, you know, where you can't go home. You know, it kind of makes sense. I hate to say it. It kind of makes sense.
Well, that's what they're talking about for sports, right? They're saying maybe we'll just keep all the players together. Like, imagine telling a bunch of football, basketball, and baseball players, young men, millionaires, used to having fun, that you're not going to be able to go out and date and see people and party and go to clubs. Really? For the entire season? I don't think that'll go over so well. And of course, they may just do the quarantine for 2 weeks and then test everyone and then start to work to make sure I'm not starting out with people who are sick and then encourage best practices. That might be another alternative. They're certainly going to have testing of everyone every day, if at all possible. They have saliva tests that are coming out now. Those are very quick tests that can take 15 to 20 minutes. They'll have temperature tests and maybe, though we don't know yet, people with a certain level of antibodies, maybe they won't have to be tested every day. We don't know yet. The science isn't there. But even what you're going to film, that's a problem. What are they going to do about crowd scenes?
You know, just use just cut to the same crowd. It should actually just be a crowd scene that they have on file. Like
everyone
people
uses.
Applauding. Yeah, that everybody uses. It's like the scream, that scream that everybody uses in horror movies. It's always the same scream.
That's like the first original Battlestar Galactica had great special effects, ships flying through space, things exploding. You're like, wow, the pilot was very, very impressive, state-of-the-art, expensive special effects. And then week two, that looks really familiar, that shot that they, week three,
I've seen
every special effect 3 times now, not working so well anymore. But
exactly. So they will have to do it digitally, really, is what you'll find out.
But there's only so much you can do, but they're going to have to do something like that. Intimacy scenes may be rethought. Maybe you'll just, you know, put your hand towards them. That'll be sexy enough for us in this day and age. Actors.
There will be people like, you know, they'll just be doing like they'll be on different sides of the window with their hand on the window.
It'll be Midnight Express again and again and again.
Or Arrival. Didn't she do that in Arrival with the alien? Like she touched the.
I don't think it was a sex scene, but yes. Maybe it was for you. Anyway, actors are the big problem here. You know what? I have a friend who's a still photographer and he's dying to get back to work and thinks it's all overblown and we have a big argument about it. But I said, yeah, you know what? The actors, they need an extra layer of protection. They can't wear protective gear while filming. And you know what? They can't be replaced. If a still photographer gets sick on the set and has to go home, God forbid, so what? That will be the attitude of everybody. So what if a cinematographer or a key grip or a still photographer, but if an elite actor then your whole production is threatened. So those people are going to have to be treated with kid gloves. You're going to have to go to extreme measures to try and keep them as safe as possible. And then we get to...
Well, you know, they say the coronavirus, COVID-19, is not as bad in kids. So yeah, you definitely want kid gloves.
There we go. Craft services. When you make that joke, you'll be sent... Go away, get some food, come back. You're getting a little low on energy. But there won't be bowls of M&Ms anymore. Everything will be single serving, and you'll have staggered meals to cut down on density. That just seems like a given. That surely will be something that happens.
Yeah, it's just easy. I mean, basically, these craft service tables are just like little snack areas where you can go and there's like pretzels and chips. Yeah, always something to eat, something to drink. Now it'll just be there, but it'll be in like, you know, packages, as you say.
And you won't all stand around there and chat, which was a good part of it. It was a social thing. Guess what? Fun fact, I worked craft services on Nora Ephron's You've Got Mail.
Really?
I did indeed. At Lincoln Square, when they were filming there, there's a scene where they go to the movies, and I actually worked there when they filmed it, and then I saw the movie in Lincoln Square, and there was such a hilarious buzz of noise from the audience when they entered that actual theater. Like, people were sort of turning around, looking up at the balcony, going, are they here? Are they? Well, no, it's a film. They're not here, you know, but it was
very meta.
There will be no sharing of M&Ms or sharing of anything. You know, crew members would say, hey, Bob, you got a hammer, and they hand you a hammer. Hey, Sue, you got another lens, she hand you a lens. Well, that's not going to happen. Every crew member will have to have their own complete set of tools to do their jobs. There won't be shared cell phones. Apparently there's, you know, just group cell phones that are used to communicate and stuff like that. That will end. No doorknobs. You know, on backstage stuff, we're not talking about the actual set where you're filming, but going into crafts, going into somebody's trailer, going into the room where you're editing, if you're editing on set, going to the room where directors sit or people meet or whatever, everywhere there's a door, it's going to be turned into a swinging door so people can go in and out without having to touch the handle. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah, no, well, that's what they're doing in movie theaters, too. All the doors are open.
And, well, that's a lot of rehanging of doors going on. That's a good business right now. And like we said before, maybe they'll rent entire hotels so everyone can isolate and cohabitate together. Of course, there will be cleaning crews disinfecting after every day's shooting or every night's shooting. Overseas shoots, they think, might be problematic. They're saying, you know what, TV shows might be limited to just studio lots, no on-location work. Maybe you're not going to be ready to go back to certain countries. But maybe you are ready to go back to work overseas if it's New Zealand and you feel like they got a much better handle on things. And of course,
apparently Iceland has gotten a lot of phone calls to find out about whether they could shoot there.
Oh, are they doing well?
I guess so. Yeah. And the studios, the sound stages and studios in Iceland are like, why is everybody calling us all of a sudden? Well, it's because there's...
Why would they be confused? Why would they be confused? Wouldn't they know?
Well, they kind of know, yes, but it seemed to be all of a sudden they were like, oh, we get it. Yeah, no, we don't want your coronavirus. Take it with you.
And of course, what will you be filming? Because should TV shows reflect the new reality? Certainly medical shows are going to do that. They've already said we have to put all the latest stuff in place. It's going to make it a big pain, but that's what they have to do. They're going to work around it. But, you know, I think multi-camera sitcoms might explode in popularity. Forget those one-camera shows going out on location. And demure Jane Austen costume dramas will have a huge rise in popularity because you can have intimacy without actually having getting down and dirty and kiss and have sex. You know, a smoldering look is all you need in a Jane Austen costume drama.
So, what about Bollywood? What about Bollywood?
Exactly. You know, they're ready. They haven't been kissing for years.
Yes, that's right. You know who's not kissing anymore?
A wop, bop, a loo, bop, a womp, bam, boom.
Little Richard, that's right. He died at the age of 87.
This is the, you know, you don't rank people when they die. All the people that we mentioned, we have something to say about them, or they're really influential. We've talked about them before, or they're groundbreakers we didn't know about. Little Richard, everyone knows about, and all came from just 2 years. He had 2 years where he made a lot of hits. Then he found Jesus, got born again. Then he got unborn again. Then he got born again. Then he got unborn. He's had a great, colorful career, but the reason we talk about him today are still the songs that came out in a 2 year period from like 56 to 57. Tutti Frutti, Good Golly Miss Molly. He was sexy. He was provocative. He was earth shaking. And fascinatingly, you know, he was outrageous times 10 in an era where that was really dangerous, especially for a person of color. But fascinatingly, from the get-go, he always appealed very strongly to both a black and a white audience, which is one reason why, you know, people may have been even more freaked out about him than normal. And when Pat Boone covered Tutti Frutti and charted higher, Little Richard sang his next hit, Long Tall Sally, at an even more frenetic pace, just so poor Pat Boone couldn't keep up. He's like, oh, really, white boy? And then he sang the Long Tall Sally. Maybe you and I, he just went crazy on that song, and Pat Boone couldn't do it. So,
you know, I actually saw him perform a couple times, just tribute. You know, I think one was like an Elton John. It was like an Elton John tribute. How was he in the 90s? He was fine. He did. I remember thinking, wow, he's really good. But I also would run into him. He lived for 20 years,
You. Everybody lives. Everybody's around.
No. Actually, he lived for like 80 to I think the 80s and 90s. He lived in what I knew as the Rock and Roll Hyatt on Sunset Boulevard. He lived on the third floor, and he would just stop by people's party. It was like, this was the place where like the doors threw TVs out the window. And, you know, I'm butchering what this place is, but it's still on the Sunset Strip. It's still a hotel, and it's adored by, you know, rock legends because of it. Or now, you know, people who are trying to become rock legends because so many people have stayed there or lived there. Little Richard, you could always find there. Mm-hmm. It was remarkable.
The Beatles opened for him at the Star Club in Hamburg, Germany, before they were the Beatles. The Stones opened for him, he opened for the Stones. I forget which, but a huge influence on everybody. He's in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, a major, major artist, fascinating guy. Prince, of course, you know, he said, I was wearing purple before you were born. You know, he's crazy, over the top guy. That really is, along with his songs, that outrageousness, that sense of just a star, a crazy person. You didn't know what they were going to say next, putting on a performance all the time. So almost the Andy Warhol idea. That's also a really big part of his legacy. And of course, he's gay, but depending on what day of the week you were talking to him. You know, he was in relationship with women. He did adopt a son, but at various times throughout his career, he would denounce homosexuality, especially when he became born again. Then he would call himself omnisexual in an interview with Penthouse. And then at other times he'd say, oh no, I've been gay my whole life. Come on. So you never knew what you were going to get from Little Richard. And that was true from beginning to end. So what a great guy. A little quicker, another great singer, Grammy-winning soul singer Betty Wright, died at 66. Her big hits are Clean Up Woman and the song Where Is the Love, that she won a Grammy for. She's also, this is cool, the first Black woman to release a gold record on her own label. She started her label, released an album, had a big hit with it. So that's very cool.
Wow, it's kind of like a diversity episode.
Well, that's right. Germany, we don't talk about a lot of German musicians, but Kraftwerk, their co-founder Florian Schneider died at 73. We've talked about them at least once a year when we talk about the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. They are Grammy winners, hugely influential, all thanks to the album Autobahn and others. And they were perennial bridesmaids at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. I thought they deserved to be in, and maybe, no, who knows, someday soon they will be. Another big figure missing the music is André Harrell. He's a founder of Uptown Records, and he died too young, 59 years old. Good Lord. He was a major player in East Coast R&B and hip hop as a producer and a label head. He founded Uptown Records. He hired Sean Puffy Combs as an intern. He discovered Mary J. Blige, and you can stop right there. But he also helped launch the careers of Heavy D and the Boys, I'll Be Sure, Guy, Robin Thicke, and many more. Back in the 90s, when hip-hop was becoming huge, he helped produce the TV series New York Undercover. He briefly headed Motown. He was a big, big player. In fact, BET, the cable channel, had just announced they were going to make a mini-series about his career and Uptown Records, a fictionalized story about his career. They're still going ahead with that three-part mini-series. Sadly, André Harrell won't be around to see it.
Well, and here's one that I did not know until I was reading the show notes. Jerry Stiller died at the age of 92. He is, of course, the husband of Ann Mira and the father of Ben and Amy Stiller. But, you know, he's a comedian. He started, in the 60s?
Yeah, or even the 50s. But yeah, he and his wife, you know, he and his wife Ann Mira were a comedy duo. They came huge on the Ed Sullivan Show and the Mike Douglas Show and stuff like that. And then they did decades of character work, and they had their son, and it looked like maybe they become more famous for being the dad of Ben Stiller, which I'm sure they were proud and happy of. But then suddenly in their 60s, they became huge again.
Well, because, you know, Jerry Stiller, actually wound up playing Frank Costanza, George Costanza's father on Seinfeld.
And more importantly, the key celebrant of Festivus, the festival for the rest of us, which I celebrate every year with feats of strength and so on. Airing of grievances, I do that with Sperling every week. And then, wasn't enough, one of the biggest hits of all time, he followed that up with another hit sitcom, The King of Queens. He was like, I'm retired. And Kevin James said, I can't do the show without you. You've got to come on the show. He's like, all right. And then another 200 episodes, you know, another monster hit for him. And here's a cute story. He met Ann Mirror at a casting director's office, I assume in the 50s or early 60s. She was upset. She just had an unpleasant experience. And he took her out for coffee, which was the only thing he could afford at the time. And they were together from then on till she died in 2015.
Yeah.
Another happy romance was Siegfried and Roy. Sadly, Roy of Siegfried and Roy, that famous duo, he died at 75. He died of complications from COVID-19, not the tiger attack that so abruptly and sadly ended their storied Las Vegas career. Obviously, of course, they were a mainstay on the strip for decades. Michael Jackson even recorded a theme song for one of their shows. And tragically, that tiger attack led to injuries for Roy and the abrupt ending of their fairy tale career. He always insisted he was having a stroke and the tiger was pulling him off stage to help rescue him. God bless him for being loyal to your animals right up to the end. But they were akin to Little Richard in terms of living together for many decades, but being private about their lives. But, you know, very right. Sad to see, you know, it's just a sad, sad ending. Anybody who's watched Tiger King knows, you know what? These animals are not pets.
No, they are not at all. Mm-hmm. They are wild animals. In fact, keep in mind, your cat, if it was big enough, would eat you. I mean, your house cat.
I don't doubt it for a second.
Yeah. Now, also dying was film music editor Elsie Blangstead.
Died at 99. I've never heard of her. Have you?
She's a film music editor.
Right.
Actually. So she worked with, you know, name the person, whether it's Robert Redford,
Jones, Jack Nicholson, Tony Richards, Sidney Pollack, Richard Pryor, Carl Reiner, Stanley Kramer, Richard Donner, many, many more.
Yeah. I mean, she was, I think, even awarded the a Lifetime Achievement Award by the Motion Picture Sound Editors.
That's right. And she was the first music editor to be thus awarded. In fact, I had to look up specifically what a music editor is. They're responsible for compiling, editing and syncing music during the production of a soundtrack. It sounds almost like the sound mixer person, but it's specifically focused on the music. They also often create a temp track. She was a Holocaust survivor, a bit player who segued into music editing and enjoyed decades of championing and challenging composers. Artists loved her. They gushed about her in tributes, including Dave Grusin, who she worked with a lot, Robert Redford, and actor James Cromwell, who was very sweet about saying, you know, she walked out to him the first time they met and said, you want to dance? Because they were at some thing. And he said, we've been dancing for 30 years ever since. He said she was one of his best friends. And Randy Newman said this, she was a brilliant woman. I loved her. She wished me well, even after she knew me.
He's such a self-deprecating guy, Randy.
And for her memorial, of course, she has curated the music. She said, God Bless the Child by Billie Holiday is number one, she said. And I'd also like Randy Newman to be there to perform You Can Leave Your Hat On, which is a very sexy, funny song to have played at your memorial. And speaking of memorials, if you want to read my ever-changing funeral playlist, the music I say, hey, you want to think of me and what I celebrate and think about life, not music to make you sad, but music to inspire you, check out my funeral playlist. It's on Spotify. And we have a link in our show notes. This isn't set in stone. I twiddle with it all the time when a new song strikes me. Hey, that needs to be in the mix. But you can check it out right now if you're wondering what it would be like to sit at my memorial.
Well, let's hope that we're not doing that next week.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. But in the meantime, you can subscribe to our show in any podcast aggregator, iTunes, Google Play Store, Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, anywhere they give podcasts away for free. You can find us. Please do rate and review us in those podcast aggregators. It does help us out when you do. That information can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's also where you'll find ways to contact us. dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. We're on Twitter, where our handle is @showbizsandbox, or on Facebook, facebook.com/showbizsandbox. Again, all that information is on our website, showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on their own website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz has a website, and every week it's something new and exciting. What is it this week, Michael?
Ba-ba-loo-ba-ba-wa-bam-boom.
Now, how do you spell that? And is it a .com?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, .org. Yeah. Well, if you can't find any of Michael's coverage of the entertainment industry there, why not head on over to michaelgiltz.com, where all of his work is aggregated. My work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.